Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When today's guest, Anne Ravel, resigned from the Federal Election Commission in 2017, she told Donald Trump that the agency was not living up to its mission of ensuring a fair electoral process. Instead, a small group of wealthy individuals have a disproportionate amount of influence on government and our lives. Pointing to the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, Anne Ravel denotes how unlimited and untraceable amounts of money have poured into elections, manipulating the electoral process. While Anne Ravel has stepped down from the FEC, she is continuing her fight to rid elections of secret money and diminish the influence of big moneyed interest in politics. Anne Ravel was nominated to the FEC, where she served as commissioner and chair from October 2013 until March 2017. Previously, she served as the chair of the California Fair Political Practices Commission, appointed by Governor Jerry Brown. She is now a senior fellow at MapLight's Digital Deception Project. What a name. They do amazing work in following the money. She's also a professor at UC Berkeley Law School. Anne Ravel was featured in the film Dark Money, which we discussed in late July, and she joins me in studio. Hi, Anne. Thank you for coming in.
Hi. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you. We will talk about your decision to resign in just a minute, but because we are now into the second day of Brett Kavanaugh's Senate Supreme Court hearing, I want to start off by talking about his record on campaign finance. And once again, today's hearing opened right away with protesters. Yesterday, 70 people, mostly women, were arrested, and a lot of people are now also protesting. In 2009, Brett Kavanaugh wrote the opinion of the case Emily's List versus FEC that struck down restrictions on how nonprofits spend soft money, funds used to issue ads purely on state and local campaigns, and get out the vote work. Brett Kavanaugh wrote that these groups, quote, are constitutionally entitled to raise and spend unlimited money in support of candidates for elected office, end quote. He also wrote it is, quote, implausible that contributions to independent expenditure political committees are corrupting, end quote. What are your thoughts about the decision on that case and how it paved the way for super PACs?
That case was really important. And it, as to Kavanaugh, there's a lot of other issues as well that he's voiced, statements that show that he doesn't believe in any campaign finance limitations on even money given directly to candidates. And he also has shown in a case that he decided it called Blumen, in which he talked about foreign money being illegal when it's given directly to the candidates. But he left open very clearly, and he didn't have to even say anything about it because it wasn't before him. But he left open clearly the ability of corporations, foreign corporations, and other foreign individuals to give independent money to influence campaigns. And that's consistent with what he said in Emily's List. And actually, the truth is that there is no evidence whatsoever in the record, and instead there is plenty of evidence. That's the record of the court in saying that independent expenditures aren't corrupting. There is plenty of evidence since that time that independent expenditures are only in some cases unknown to the American public, but they're very well known to the people who are the beneficiaries of them, who are the candidates.
You said that Kavanaugh does not believe in any campaign finance limits. Can you elaborate on that?
He, at the time of the McCain-Feingold bill, when it was signed by the president, he actually wrote, and the president added it in his signing statement, that he believed that there was constitutional problems with the issue of money given directly to candidates and limitations, because there's a trend now to look at direct contributions as being problematic. And there's a couple of cases that are pending in the lower courts, one in the Ninth Circuit, and which is California, and another one that might present an opportunity for Kavanaugh to strike down any limits.
Any limits. So what would that mean?
It would mean open season, in particular for, obviously, for the very wealthy or for corporate interests.
Because right now, there's so much flowing. I feel like we've been talking about money in politics for over a decade on this show, and every year, the records just keep getting, the amount of money just is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and so much of it is now dark. We don't know who's giving because it's untraceable. So you're saying that it can even get worse than what we have today?
Yes, it can. And that's the concern that most people who are involved with campaign finance and campaign finance reform are very concerned about Kavanaugh's potential appointment.
What are your thoughts on the influence of money in politics? Because we talk about everything from prison reform to poverty to housing to programs for youth, I mean, healthy food, you name it. And it all, so much of that all goes back to money in politics.
There's no question. And I think part of the problem with campaign finance is that when people talk about it, they talk about it in sort of more general terms, like it's a concern for democracy because it creates an unequal playing field. And of course, the Supreme Court doesn't care about unequal voice. They think that that is not a basis for campaign finance laws. But really, what if people understood that campaign finance is at the root of most policies in this country? And what there's some political scientists who have actually done studies on this issue. Gillens and Page are among them, but there's others. And what they found was federal policy, about 99%, and that includes regulations as well as laws, benefit the very wealthy or corporate interests, and grassroots groups and the others have no influence whatsoever.
Mm. I remember a Princeton study that came out maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and it looked at where the people stand on any number of issues, including money in politics, climate change, minimum wage, taxing the wealthy, and like 70% of the people are together on those issues. And the politicians, a minority, are on the completely other side. And that is because of money in politics.
That's absolutely right. And you can see also, I mean, I think that it's striking when you sometimes see the results of a large amount of money that goes to candidates or to their committees. And then there are votes on the favor, in the favor of those particular organizations or groups. For example, I mean, it's well known, it's been said and shown publicly that a great deal of money went to Ryan right after the tax reform bill was passed from the Koch brothers. And so there's obviously a correlation in that respect. And there's others like that. I mean, I think it's recently been served. I'm very, very concerned about some of the issues that are basically human rights consumer issues. And lead paint poisoning is an issue that concerns me greatly in this state because of the efforts by the paint companies to put initiatives on the ballot in California. But in Wisconsin, after or during the time of the recall election for Scott Walker, $700,000, which is a lot in Wisconsin, was given to Scott Walker to fight his recall effort right before the campaign by a paint company that was concerned about lead paint. And within 2 weeks after he was reelected, or not removed, Scott Walker signed a bill giving total immunity to the paint companies for lead paint poisoning.
And this happens really across the country.
Yes.
On a regular basis.
Yes.
It's legal.
It is. It's perfectly legal.
Today we are speaking with Anne Ravel. She was nominated to the Federal Election Commission, where she served as commissioner and chair from October 2013 until March 2017. And she resigned in 2017, telling Trump that the agency was not living up to its mission of ensuring a fair electoral process. If you have any questions for Anne Ravel about money in politics and what the FEC is supposed to do, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And you also mentioned what might be in store for the ability of foreign corporations or foreign entities to spend money on elections in the United States. What does the law say today?
Well, the law is very clear that there cannot be foreign intervention or assistance in a political campaign in the United States. That is very clear. But what isn't clear is who that describes. That is it a foreign corporation? And if it's a foreign corporation, is there some, you know, sort of ownership, for example, of a subsidiary? A lot of subsidiaries in the United States of foreign corporations give lots of money to campaigns. And we know that according to corporate law, that subsidiaries, even if they are separate and independent, are governed by the governing board under the principles of corporations and have to follow their lead in terms of what policies are. But nonetheless, those people give freely to campaigns because it isn't independently. They can't give directly now, but independently, and there's nothing that prohibits it. And the FEC repeatedly refused to ever do any regulations about that issue.
Why not?
Well, as you know, and you probably were going to be asking me about this, but because the FEC consists of six commissioners, three of them, no more than three of them, can be of one political party. And when I was on the commission and prior to my time, the three Republican commissioners, for ideological reasons, all voted as a bloc and refused to enact any regulations about this issue.
And when did that begin?
It began when there were three vacancies on the commission, and they were all Republican vacancies. And my understanding is Don McGahn suggested to Senator Mitch McConnell that if he were to appoint three members, all of whom, including himself, all of whom voted as a bloc, they could block anything from ever happening at the FEC.
And Don McGahn is the White House counsel and Trump's official lawyer, right?
Yes, he is.
Okay, so this is what really struck me in the Dark Money film, is to see video of these three Republicans always voting as a bloc and, as a result, never allowing anything to happen. And according to the people who were quoted in the film, including you, this is unprecedented.
It is unprecedented. Prior, the FEC, while it is not intended to be a very strong, powerful commission with good reason, because they can make decisions, if they are purely political, that impact people's careers. And so the idea was that it would be balanced. And in the past, and I've been told this by many commissioners who were on the commission for many years, including in the film, Trevor Potter, who is a Republican commissioner, who said during their tenure, there were deadlocks maybe two or three times, not very often. When I was on the commission, the deadlocks went up so radically from 2010 until when I left in 2017 that essentially any matter of any significance, whether it be disclosure, whether it be foreign money, whether it be other private personal use of money, we could never investigate any of those issues because they refused to vote even to investigate.
Were you able to have conversations with them to talk about why this is happening, or who, I mean, what's their background? Where do they come from?
Well, at the time, one of them had been on the Hill, I believe, and also worked for the Republican majority. The other one had been at the Election Assistance Commission appointed, and my understanding was her real role at the Election Assistance Commission was to increase voter suppression. And the third one was also very active in Republican circles in Virginia and very much a libertarian. So they all viewed themselves as essentially Republican operatives, which I think was very different from the people who were occupying the Democratic seats. For example, the other two commissioners who were Democrats were both essentially appointed by Harry Reid. One of them considers himself to be an independent. He's still there. And when I was appointed, I was not appointed specifically by a senator because – or recommended by a senator even because I had worked at the Justice Department at the beginning of the Obama administration. And obviously I'm a Democrat, but I've never been active in Democratic campaigns or the Democratic Party. And so I think the composition was very different. But the real difference, and this is what caused me so much grief on the commission, was these were people that were there to perform a particular mission. And the mission of the agency is very important. It's very important because it really is about ensuring that there's a fair electoral process and ensuring that the public has trust in government and in that process. And so they joined a commission knowing that they didn't believe in the mission of that organization at all. And further, they were all lawyers, and lawyers, their professional obligation is to adhere to the law. And Don McGahn himself, at a public meeting, once said, "I don't enforce the law as Congress intended it. I plead guilty as charged."
Wow. And he is actually stepping down from his role in the White House.
He is.
Today we're speaking with Anne Ravel, former chair at the FEC. She resigned, telling Trump that the agency was not living up to its mission of ensuring a fair electoral process. And let's take a couple of calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for this information. I'm an advocate of public finance for campaigns and elections, but I don't think that's going to go anywhere soon. And I don't think the national stuff is going to change much. probably even get worse. So what I'm interested in is your thoughts about what could be done in the state of California. I'm not that familiar with campaign finance laws in the state of California, to be honest with you, but I'm wondering if anything is either on the books or could be. I might make a suggestion on along this line, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is that, you know, any contribution made by an individual, organization, company, et cetera, to a candidate or a candidate's campaign above, say, $5,000, whenever an ad is out on TV or print or whatever, or social media, that all the contributors and the amounts that they've contributed, their affiliations, need to be in bold print so that people will at least know who's giving the money. And they can make a judgment from there. I don't know if that's feasible, but I'd love to hear what you think about it.
Well, actually, the law in California is pretty good, and there's recently been passed and signed by the governor the Disclose Act in California that has been many years in the making. It doesn't require every donor to be listed because that would be not feasible on, say, the internet or even on television ads, but it does require the top, I believe it's four donors to be and it to be listed. And when it is a donor that is a group like a 501c4, and they're called something like, you know, Americans Who Love Puppies, they have to list their donors as well. So that's a step towards what you're suggesting, and I think it's good. California can still have more robust laws about disclosure. And disclosure is really what's left. It's what's important to tell the public about who's behind campaigns and who's trying to influence their votes. It's been found constitutional so far by the United States Supreme Court. In fact, they think that it's a positive. And so I think, and I'm actually working with a group that's called Voters Right to Know, and ultimately they'll want to work in California. And the part of the hope is to have a constitutional amendment that will put the right to that transparency in the California Constitution. And they're also working in other states and want to do the same in those states, and then have a kind of a enacting legislation ultimately that would be able to trace back to the original sources, because that's part of the problem. The dark money is the problem. Mm. And the fact that people will say, yes, we have X committee that's giving us money, and then nobody knows that the money has been transferred circuitously through either another 501c4 or a limited liability corporation. And so by the time you get to the original source, you're in the dark. Mm. And that's what's happened.
Right. And well, thank you for the call, Greg. And after the break, I'd love, Anne, to get your take on all the money that's spent on propositions across the country. I mean, here in California, hundreds of millions of dollars are spent. People don't know what's true, what's not. They're bombarded with flyers, and they get so angry at the entire process. Anne Ravel was nominated to the FAC, where she served as commissioner and chair from October 2013 until she stepped down in March 2017. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the power of environmental films. The San Francisco Green Film Fest is kicking off on September 6th, and we will talk about two films, Symphony for Nature, a visual and orchestral documentary about natural history, and Wilder Than Wild. That film examines the growing intensity of wildfires in the West. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. org. Today, we are joined by Ann Ravel. She served on the Federal Election Commission as chair and commissioner from October 2013 until she resigned March 2017. When she resigned, she wrote in a letter, quote, "People from all walks of life should be able to run for office without having to seek out wealthy donors or be wealthy themselves, and all political spending should be transparent to encourage trust in our political system," end quote. Ann Ravel is a senior fellow at MapLight's Digital Deception Project and professor at UC Berkeley Law School. She was featured in the film Dark Money, which we discussed in late July. That's a really great film that I hope all of you can see. And I wanted to ask you another question about California. Delaine Easton, who ran for governor in California, wrote an op-ed in the Chronicle in October called Get Money Out of Politics in California. And she pointed out, and I remember this because we did a show about it, in 2016, the pharmaceutical industry spent more than $100 million to prevent voters from regulating the price of prescription drugs, and they won $100 million on a proposition in California. I think they broke records with that one.
That could be.
So what can we do about the proposition money? Because our ballot is so long in this state, and there's so much money that is spent every election.
Right. And I've often said about ballots and ballot measures that those measures, while they were intended to be grassroots, as you say, they aren't. In order to get them on the ballot, to get the signatures to put them on the ballot, it requires so much money in California because of the competition and how many there are and the number of voters. So it's not any longer sort of the people's democracy. What it is, though, when people vote on those issues, it's as if the public is sitting as the legislature. Mm. And yet they sit as the legislature with not sufficient information. And often they don't know who's behind those ballot measures because it's like the pharmaceutical that is paying and they don't necessarily use their name and say that that's who they are. I think one of the iconic there have been several, but a number of years ago, I think it was the 2012 election, PG&E is in the news a lot today, so this is a good example. They put a measure on the ballot that was called something innocuous that would get people to vote, something like, you know, save your taxes or something like that, and that was the committee. And it really was to prevent local governments from enacting their own measures to get their own energy companies so that they would compete with PG&E and be cheaper for the public. Well, PG&E's ballot measure would have required something a two-thirds vote, I believe, of the local population to enact such a thing. And since no one knew who they were, people were sort of believing that that was okay until they found out that it was actually sponsored by PG&E. And at that point, once they found out who was behind it, they turned it down. Hmm. And that's been a fairly consistent issue. There was a lot of dark money. And this is at the beginning of the Dark Money film where you saw me in front of a series of here's money that passed from this committee to this committee. Mm-hmm. This happened in California. Also in, I believe it was also in 2012. And it had to do with Governor Brown's tax measure and then a measure relating to prohibiting unions from participating in political campaigns. And what turned out to be $15 million poured into a PAC in California for the purpose of supporting the union measure and fighting the Brown's tax measure. And nobody knew where it came from. It came from ostensibly a group in Arizona that nobody had ever heard of. They'd never participated in campaigns. And it turned out these were all Koch groups.
Right. And when you were the chair of California's Fair Political Practices Commission at that time, you helped bring to light the Koch brothers' network of donors.
Right. We decided that it was important for the public to know who was behind that before the election. And that case was within a space of a couple of weeks. It went all the way to the California Supreme Court that met on a Sunday, in a very unusual session, unanimously deciding that these groups had to turn over the information about who their donors were, so and who was really behind those committees. They didn't. They just gave the names of other committees, but they also admitted to essentially money laundering, and that case ultimately went to trial and after the election, and we found out that they were all Koch groups.
And how did you find out exactly? Because we have reporters on, and we always ask them, how do you follow the money? Mm-hmm. And in some cases, they say it's getting harder and harder.
It is very hard. In that case, there was testimony that came from both the PAC in California and the people who ran that PAC, and what happened to the money, how it all got transferred first to Virginia, and then because the money actually originated in California from big donors who didn't want to be disclosed, so the money went to Virginia, and then they didn't comply with California law early enough, and so they had to then transfer it to Arizona and Iowa. It was crazy.
Wow.
It's crazy. And it's harder now. And one of the reasons it's harder is a lot of people are now setting up limited liability corporations, which I know in California, you just have to pay $75. You could set up a corporation, and nobody is really looking at the money and how the money is transferring, and they give money to campaigns.
At the time, you said this case highlights the dark money nonprofit networks hiding the identities of their contributors. The California Fair Political Practices Commission is aggressively litigating to get disclosure and working on laws and regulations to put a stop to these practices in California. So where are we today?
Well, actually, after I left the FPPC, we had been working on a law which the legislature in California enacted, and in a bipartisan fashion. This is what's different about California than the federal government. And the law is pretty good at getting to the sources of contributions. It could be better, and particularly could be better in determining who's behind money and communications on the internet.
And we'll talk about that also on today's show. We are speaking on today's Your Call with Ann Ravel. She was nominated to the FEC, where she served as commissioner and chair from October 2013 until she resigned in March of last year. She told Trump that the agency was not living up to its mission of ensuring a fair electoral process. Ann Ravel is now senior fellow at MapLight's Digital Deception Project and professor at UC Berkeley Law School. She's also featured in the documentary Dark Money, which we discussed in late July. The focus is on Montana. It's such a fascinating documentary, and I hope you can check it out. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. As I try to put together what the guest has said, I have a sense that in terms of local of individuals having an effect and corporations not having an effect on the political process, we have the least effect individuals, and the corporations have the greatest effect at the national level. At the state level, the situation is somewhat better, and at the local level, it's even better. When you have a local election, if there's large corporations putting a lot of money into it, it actually serves negatively because it's a David and Goliath kind of picture, and people don't like that. So I would like to get the guest perspective on to what degree, since there doesn't seem to be much hope to do anything on the federal level, to what degree it's beneficial to have power about what takes place devolved to local levels. Such things, for instance, as pesticide regulation, that can be done on a local level. Air pollution can be done on a state level. I hope she gets the gist of what I'm saying. Would we benefit from having more local control and more ability of localities to take action and less power given to the federal government?
I don't think there's any question that particularly now, there's much more ability to impact policy at the local level and even the state level throughout the country. And there's a, you know, there's a second reason why that is positive, because I think as change progresses across the country on these issues that you mentioned and many others, that almost creates a barrier, and hopefully the Supreme Court will respect the decisions, particularly if they are ultimately put, as I said before, put into the local constitutions. They'll respect the local sort of power to have influence over their own communities and will not find them to be contrary to the law. There isn't a guarantee in that, but because the issues of federalism have been discussed for many years, and now those people who are in power in the Supreme Court, assuming Kavanaugh is also on the court, it might be less possible, but I do think that as a defensive matter, it is puts local entities in stronger positions and is able. Well, the other thing, as you said, I think people have so much more ability to influence their local city councils, their boards of supervisors. They see them in the grocery store. They're part of the community. These are people who care about the community and don't have a partisan approach. I was county council in Santa Clara County for many years and saw that you know, people are elected because they care about their constituents.
Can you point to a local federal election law that you think should be emulated across the country or is very strong?
You mean,
like a local, I'm sorry, a local campaign finance law that removes money out of politics?
Well, you know, Montana, you mentioned Montana. Montana, and that's what makes this movie so interesting. They've had a long history of corruption and a lot of history of corporate interests and heads of corporations basically buying the state. And so from early in the 1900s, they've had laws restricting corporate involvement because of that issue. And they have some really good local laws, and California does too. The problem, for example, the Montana, one of the Montana laws is one of the ones relating to what can constitute corruption enough to permit that, and this is pending at the Ninth Circuit, to permit a local government from making a decision about campaign finance. And that's going to be the issues that are pending before the court.
Well, thank you for calling, William. Let's go next to Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. I've got two questions for the professor about what's arguably the original sin of all this, which is the 1977 Buckley v. Valeo case. One is, it was a per curiam decision, so we don't know who wrote it, and it was 7-2. It was a strange decision to come out of a liberal burger court, and I was wondering if the professor knew anything about how the decision was put together, and particularly where were Brennan and Marshall in that 7-2. And then secondly, what does she think about the jurisprudence of the decision with respect to the argument that money equals speech, and did they ground that in any originalist doctrine? Is there anything that you can find in, you know, the debates on the Constitution or the Federalist or anything like that that justifies that assertion?
I appreciate the question, and I don't know enough about the history of it. And your question, though, definitely is sparking my interest, and I'm going to go look that up and see what the background is, because I do think that it's really important. So I appreciate your pointing that out for me. I think that when you read the Buckley decision, and by the way, Brennan, I would be really surprised if either of those two were, people who went along with the decisions in the Buckley case. I think for me, the issue that is the worst in Buckley, the question about money and speech is a problem because of how it's ultimately worked out in our system, but per se, you can see that money is used to be able to get your speech out. And so you can kind of see a correlation. But I think that the reason that it is such a problem in that case, and why the jurisprudence has then followed through to Citizens United and other cases in a really negative way for the country, is because they clearly said that there didn't need to be equal or equality of that speech, that it was important for anybody to be able to have unlimited speech and there couldn't be any constraints on it. But the problem with that is the way it's been sort of ultimately decided in court decisions, and even in Buckley, is that individuals who don't have the money to be able to either run for office or speak out and pay for ads can't have the same speech. And when people have been trying to do campaign finance reform that has public financing, and they give a little more money for the person who's running for office who doesn't have a lot of money. It's a Bennett case in Arizona, and that impacts the wealthy person because then they have to give more money. That was found unconstitutional. I mean, it's crazy how it's been interpreted. And the other thing is, it doesn't look at the American public's right to hear speech and the right to participate in robust conversations about political matters. And so what you just hear is the speech of the wealthy. Mm-hmm. As people have said, they get to amplify their speech.
Right. And in fact, one person can keep a campaign going, which is what we saw with Trump.
Right.
The Mercers, he was about to falter, and they gave his campaign a huge infusion of cash.
Him and who knows who else.
Exactly. Well, so at the federal level, there's a huge movement to overturn Citizens United. And now, like you said, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, it could even get worse to the point where corporations can just spend endless amounts of money. But what do you think needs to happen in order to truly take on this issue at the federal level?
I think that a movement for a constitutional amendment, excuse me, is unlikely to succeed. And I'm, you know, a pragmatist. And so what I like to see are things that have some possibility of being accomplished. And one of those things is more robust disclosure. I mean, even Justice Kennedy, who wrote Citizens United, when asked at Harvard Law School about a year or two ago about, you know, you wrote Citizens United and you said there should be disclosure, but, you know, that may not really be the case. And he said, yes, well, it's not working the way it's supposed to. Of course, anybody could have predicted that.
Right.
But, you know, so but that's a place, I think, where there's some hope, at least. I think the ability to change the balance can also work at local levels where there are local sort of like Seattle has a voucher system and Connecticut has a public financing system. So that can change the dynamic locally.
Let's talk about what we know about online ads and whether it's foreign actors or groups that we don't know about who are trying to manipulate public opinion and advance their agenda. What concerns you the most? We've got executives from Twitter and Facebook testifying, probably as we're speaking right now.
Yes. We know that there was clearly Russian intervention in the 2016 election. What we and this was by advertising, by bots that mobilized people to go to rallies, and that also engaged in voter suppression by telling African American groups through phony Facebook pages not to vote. And so we know that happened. We know it happened. It was micro-targeted for those areas where there would be the possibility of affecting the election, swing states that we know the vote was very small that affected where the Electoral College votes went. So we know that. But we also know that this mechanism is being used for actors within the United States. We know because Facebook admitted it a week or so ago that it was again happening in this election, and it was not just Russia but Iran. Microsoft has talked about the problem and publicly and is trying to do something to ameliorate it. So this is a pervasive problem, and it includes dark money groups, not just Russia, not just China, not just others.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how pervasive is it and how do we know how pervasive it is?
Well, there are people who are able to look at bot activity on the internet and see where some of these, some of it, what people call fake news, which I think is a ridiculous term because it's really political propaganda. Mm. Being used to influence not just people's views of government, but to influence elections ultimately. But there are people who can at least get a feel for what happened that are researching these things and know that it occurred. They may not be able to get to the sources, although I know there's been a recent study by a University of Wisconsin professor, Young Mi Kim, and it did have to do with she started looking at and examining Facebook posts from prior to the 2016 election to even after, and discovered that a good 50% of them did come from, these were from Russia, and they were all concentrated number one, on communications that were racist, that were anti-immigrant, that were misogynist, and they were concentrated in particular parts of the country.
And just quickly, how should that be dealt with?
Well, I think that definitely there needs to be regulation. There needs to be government intervention in this matter, because unless it's the government, there can't be consequences. And also, it's nice that Facebook and Twitter want to do something, and Google, they want to do something. That's great. But that means that not all the same disclosure is being provided to the public. Each one's different. And we don't know if they're going to continue to do it or enforce it. So it needs to be a combination.
And 30 seconds. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but we'll have you back. You are now senior fellow at Matt Blyth's Digital Deception Project. What are you working on there?
It's essentially this, and thinking about, for my part, thinking about policies that can be enacted not just in the United States in terms of government policies and also working with the platforms, but globally, because this is a global problem.
Anne Ravel was nominated to the FEC, where she served as commissioner and chair from October 2013 until she stepped down in March 2017. She is now senior fellow at MapLight's Digital Deception Project and a professor at UC Berkeley. She's also featured in the documentary Dark Money, which we discussed in late July. Anne, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the power of environmental films. I hope you can join us for that. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Thanks to Laura Flynn for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.